Welcome back to the Deep Dive. This is our fourth segment in this series on cardiovascular optimization. And I think if the last three deep dives were about building the perfect house, today is really about the tools, the very precise, evidence-backed tools you use to seal the roof and, reinforce the foundation.
That's a perfect analogy. We've spent the last few weeks establishing that lifestyle is, without a doubt, the bedrock. We poured a lot of time into diet, the right exercise protocols, how to really push your VO2, your maximal oxygen uptake, and then how to use HRV, your heart rate variability, for stress resilience.
And those things are what, 80% of the benefit right
At
now?
least. Those steps are responsible for the vast majority of your risk reduction.
But for the listener who's done all that hard work, the optimizer who now wants to know what else is truly effective, we have to be incredibly selective. So our mission today is to filter through just this enormous volume of claims and hype around both medications and supplements.
Right. And we're focusing exclusively on high-quality clinical research. We're talking about the randomized controlled trials, the huge meta-analyses, and what the current medical guidelines actually say.
No anecdotes. No, I heard from a friend.
Absolutely not. We have to maintain scientific rigor here. We need to separate the proven therapies, the ones with hard outcome data, meaning fewer heart attacks, fewer strokes, fewer deaths, from this vast sea of popular supplements that, frankly, often lack benefit.
Or, as we'll find out, can even cause harm.
Exactly. The goal is knowledge that's both accessible but also thoroughly grounded in the science so you can integrate the right tools, the adjuncts, into your life safely and effectively.
Okay, let's start with the biggest players then. The category of drugs that cardiologists really consider the gold standard in preventative care. We have to talk about statins.
Statins are the cornerstone for a reason. If your individual risk profile, and I have to stress that your individual risk is elevated, whether from genetics or other factors, they are almost always the first pharmacologic tool that gets used.
And their official name is, let me see if I can get this right, HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors.
That's the one. It's a mouthful.
It is. So for our listener, let's just break that down. What does that enzyme, HMG-CoA reductase, actually do?
Think of it as the main spigot. It's the rate-limiting enzyme that controls cholesterol production inside your liver. By inhibiting this enzyme, statins just dramatically reduce how much cholesterol your liver makes.
Okay, so it turns the spigot
It
down.
turns it way down. But here's the really elegant part of the mechanism. Because the liver is suddenly starved of the cholesterol it was making itself, it kind of panics. It desperately needs to get cholesterol from somewhere else.
And the only other place to get it is from the blood.
Exactly. So what it does is it upregulates, it massively increases the number of LDL receptors on the surface of its cells. LDL is low-density lipoprotein.
So it's like the liver puts out all these extra large vacuum cleaners.
That's a great way to think about it. These receptors actively grab the LDLC, the low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, what people call bad cholesterol, right out of your circulation and pull it back into the liver to be processed.
Wow, so it's a dual action. It stops production and it ramps up cleanup.
It's incredibly powerful. And in terms of numbers, a medium to high dose of a statin can lower your LDLC by 30% to 50% routinely.
And this isn't just theory, right? This is backed by decades of trials.
Decades. We can look at massive trials like the HPS, the Heart Protection Study, or the JUPITER trial, which stands for the Justification for the Use of Statins in Primary Prevention, an intervention trial evaluating rosuvastatin.
Okay, let's dig into that one. What did JUPITER tell us specifically for people who haven't had a heart attack yet?
JUPITER was revolutionary. It looked at people who had normal, even low LDL levels, but they had high inflammation. They measured this with high sensitivity C reactive protein.
So on paper, their cholesterol looked fine.
Looked totally fine. But they gave these people rosuvastatin, a very powerful long-acting statin. And the trial was actually stopped early.
Why?
Because the benefit was just so overwhelming. The statin reduced major ASCVD events, that's atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, so heart attacks, strokes by nearly 44% compared to the placebo.
44%. In people who weren't even considered the highest risk to begin with.
It was a landmark. It showed us that statins weren't just about the plumbing, lowering the LDL number. They also have these potent anti-inflammatory effects, and they stabilize plaque.
So what's the general rule of thumb that's come out of all these trials?
The consensus is remarkably consistent. For every 1 millimole per liter reduction in LDL-C, which is about 39 milligrams per deciliter, you get a 20% to 25% reduction in major vascular events. It's profound, it's reliable, and it's dose dependent.
Okay, so for our 40-year-old listener who is optimizing, hasn't had an event yet, this is primary prevention, when does this conversation about maybe starting a statin actually begin?
It all comes down to objective risk assessment. Current U.S. guidelines from groups like the USPSTF, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and the ACCAHA, that's the American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association.
Right.
They recommend considering a statin if your calculated 10-year ASCVD risk is 7.5% or higher, and especially if it gets over 10%.
So you plug your age, your cholesterol numbers, blood pressure into a calculator, and that spits out the number.
Exactly. But it's not just about the score. There are also what we call risk enhancers. So if you have an LDL-C that's consistently over 160, or if you have type 2 diabetes or a really strong family history of early heart disease, you'd likely be a candidate for a statin regardless of that 10-year score.
This brings up a really critical question, though. For someone focused on optimization, that 10% threshold seems kind of high.
Mm-hmm.
Are there studies that suggest if you have high LDL, you should start earlier, even if your 10-year risk looks low just because you're only 40?
That is the perfect question for an optimizer. And yes, that's where the nuance comes in. A 10-year risk calculator can really underestimate the danger for a younger person because you just haven't had enough time to have an event yet.
So it's misleading.
It can be. If you have, say, an LDL over 190, your lifetime risk is enormous. Starting a statin at 40 in that situation is a highly proactive move to prevent plaque from ever forming decades down the line. It's all about cumulative exposure.
Okay, let's get into a crucial practical detail. Timing. Does it matter when you take the pill?
For some of them, it absolutely does, and it's based on our body's own chronobiology. We know that the liver's cholesterol-making machinery, that HMGCOA reductase enzyme, is most active at night while you're asleep.
Ah, so you want the drug to be at its peak concentration right when the enzyme is busiest.
Precisely. So the older, shorter-acting statins, think simvastatin, lovastatin, they have shorter half-lives. You want to take those in the evening or right at bedtime. That timing really maximizes their effectiveness.
What about the newer ones, like Lipitor or Crestor?
Those are the longer-acting statins, atorvastatin and rosuvastatin. Their half-lives are much longer, 19, 20 hours or more. So they maintain a really consistent, effective level in your blood all day and all night.
So for those, timing doesn't matter as much.
It's less critical. The priority shifts completely to consistency. Just pick a time you will remember every single day. With breakfast, before bed, doesn't matter. Just don't miss it. Consistency is king for those.
Okay, here's where we get to unpack a really interesting piece of knowledge. This drug-food interaction is famous,
mm-hmm.
but I think the mechanism is often really misunderstood. Let's talk about the grapefruit juice connection.
Yes, the grapefruit interaction is a textbook example of inhibiting drug metabolism. Grapefruit contains these natural compounds called furanocoumarins.
Furanocoumarins, okay.
When you consume them, they go to your gut and your liver, and they irreversibly inhibit a specific enzyme called cytochrome P450-3A4, or CYP3A4 for short.
And CYP3A4's job is what exactly?
Think of it as your body's primary garbage disposal system for drugs. It's a critical enzyme that breaks down a huge number of common medications, including many of the statins.
And when grapefruit juice shuts down the garbage disposal,
the statin builds up dramatically. Simvastatin, lovastatin, and atorvastatin all rely heavily on CYP3A4. If you drink grapefruit juice, you neutralize that enzyme. The drug can't be broken down, so way too much of the active statin floods into your bloodstream.
You're essentially turning a normal dose into a huge, potentially toxic dose.
Exactly right. Even a single glass of grapefruit juice can raise the blood levels of something like simvastatin 2 or 3-fold. And this dramatically increases the risk of side effects, mostly myalgia, which is muscle pain or, more rarely, liver issues.
So the practical insight is crucial. If you're on simvastatin, lovastatin, or atorvastatin, you just have to avoid grapefruit juice completely.
Yes. But here's the good news. There are alternatives. Not all statins use that pathway. Pravastatin and rosuvastatin are not primarily metabolized by CYP3A4, so they are grapefruit safe. If you love grapefruit, that's a conversation to have with your doctor.
Okay, let's switch gears. From statins to a medication that has seen just a complete reversal of conventional wisdom in the last few years, aspirin. For decades, it felt like every American over 50 was told to take a baby aspirin a day. That advice has completely flipped.
It's one of the most stunning reversals in preventative medicine. Aspirin, or acetylsalicylic acid, is an antiplatelet agent. At a low dose, 81 milligrams, it works by irreversibly inhibiting platelets, the little cells responsible for clotting.
And for secondary prevention, if you've already had a heart attack or a stent, it's still absolutely critical, right?
Absolutely non-negotiable in that case.
But for primary prevention, for stopping the first event in a healthy person, why did the advice change so much?
Because the entire risk-benefit calculation changed. When the original aspirin trials were done decades ago, we didn't have widespread statin use, and blood pressure control wasn't as good. So aspirin offered a clear net benefit.
But today, with statins and better blood pressure drugs, the baseline risk is already much lower.
Exactly. The overall rate of heart attack has dropped so much that the tiny marginal benefit you might get from adding aspirin is now often outweighed by the very clear, quantifiable risks of bleeding.
And what are those specific risks?
The main ones are gastrointestinal bleeding, so stomach ulcers, and more seriously, hemorrhagic stroke, which is bleeding in the brain. These aren't just theoretical risks, they are real, and they show up consistently in the studies.
So what's the latest guidance for our 40-year-old listener?
The 2022 USPSF's TSS guidelines are very clear. They now advise against starting aspirin for primary prevention in adults over 60. That's a grade D recommendation, meaning the harms outweigh the benefits.
And for the 40 to 59 age group?
For that group, they say it's an individual consideration only if your 10-year ASCVD risk is 10% or greater. And even then, they emphasize that the net benefit is very small.
So the consensus now is, unless you have some really severe risk factors or maybe documented plaque on a scan, adding a daily aspirin is probably just introducing a bleeding risk you don't need.
That's a perfect summary of the current thinking.
But let's say someone is indicated for aspirin. Can we optimize the timing?
Yes, we can. And it comes back to chronobiology again. We know that heart attacks and strokes have a peak incidence in the early morning hours, usually between 6 a.m. and noon. This is tied to a natural surge in blood pressure and platelet activity right when you wake up.
That's the high-risk window.
That's the window. So the question becomes, can we time the drug to cover it? A study called the Hermita trial looked at exactly this, comparing morning versus bedtime aspirin dosing.
And what did they find?
They found that taking aspirin at night right before bed significantly reduced morning platelet reactivity by 22 aspirin reaction units compared to taking it in the morning.
So the drug is working hardest exactly when the platelets are at their most dangerous.
It suggests better protection during that high-risk window. While the trial wasn't large enough to prove fewer heart attacks, the mechanism is sound. So for someone who is indicated for aspirin, taking it in the evening is a smart, evidence-based strategy.
Okay, this next part might be the single most important practical warning in this whole segment. The interaction between aspirin and common pain relievers like ibuprofen.
This is a huge one, and it undermines the protection for so many people. Aspirin works because it irreversibly modifies a key site on the platelet. That effect lasts for the entire life of the platelet, 7 to 10 days.
But ibuprofen binds to that exact same spot.
The exact same spot, but it binds reversibly. So they're literally fighting for the same parking space on the platelet. If you take ibuprofen before or with your aspirin, the ibuprofen gets there first and just physically blocks the aspirin from doing its permanent job.
And then when the ibuprofen wears off a few hours later,
the platelet is left completely unprotected. You've essentially wasted your aspirin dose for that day.
Wow. So what's the rule to avoid this?
The FDA has a very strict practical rule. Aspirin must be taken at least 30 minutes before ibuprofen or 8 hours after ibuprofen. That timing ensures the aspirin has time to get in, do its irreversible work, and get out before the ibuprofen can interfere.
And if you need pain relief right away?
The safest alternative is acetaminophen, like Tylenol. It works through a completely different pathway and doesn't interfere with platelets at all. It preserves the benefit of your aspirin therapy.
Okay, we've covered the big pharmaceuticals. Now let's try to navigate the incredibly messy world of supplements, and we have to be really aggressive with our filtering here, starting with omega-3 fatty acids.
Omega-3s, specifically EPA, which is eicosapentaenoic acid, and DHA, docosahexaenoic acid, are fascinating because the clinical results have been so confusing. It's really a tale of spectacular success right alongside spectacular failure.
And the key difference seems to be the dose and the specific formulation.
That's exactly it. Let's start with the success story that really changed the game. The REDUCEIT trial, which was published in 2018.
What does REDUCEIT stand for?
It's the Reduction of Cardiovascular Events with Icosapent Ethyl Intervention trial. They took high-risk patients who were already on statins but still had high triglycerides, and they gave them a very high dose, 4 grams a day, of pure EPA.
So a pharmaceutical-grade dose and formula, what happened?
The results just stunned the cardiology world. The high-dose EPA group saw a 25% relative reduction in major cardiovascular events, heart attack, stroke, death, over 5 years. And this was on top of a statin.
That's incredible. So that's the success. Now contrast that with the failures.
Right. So you have the VITAL trial, the vitamin D and omega-3 trial, which was massive, 25,000 healthy adults. They used a moderate dose, 1 gram a day, of mixed EPA plus DHA fish oil, and they found no significant reduction in CV events. None.
And there's another one, right? The STRENGTH trial?
Yes. STRENGTH used a high dose of a mixed EPA plus DHA formula in high-risk patients, and it was stopped early for futility. It just wasn't working.
So what is the pattern here? Why did REDUCE-IT succeed where the others failed so badly?
It seems to be two things: the right patient population, high risk, and crucially, the pure EPA formulation. There's a lot of debate, but one leading hypothesis is that at very high doses, DHA might actually interfere with some of EPA's benefits, or that you just need an incredibly high dose of pure EPA to move the needle on outcomes.
Okay, now for the shocking part, the paradox that comes with this success. High-dose omega-3 actually increases the risk of a common arrhythmia.
This is the critical piece of the puzzle. High-dose omega-3, specifically those high-dose EPA formulas, increases the risk of atrial fibrillation, or AF, by anywhere from 25 to 50%. It's dose-dependent. In the REDUCEIT trial itself, the rate of AF went from about 3.9% to 5.3%.
So wait, you're telling me you're trading a 25% drop in heart attack risk for a 25 to 50% increase in arrhythmia risk? That has to be a major clinical dilemma.
It's a profound dilemma. For our listener, the takeaway is this. If you're taking a moderate dose, say 1 gram a day of mixed EPA plus DHA, because you don't eat fish, your AF risk is minimal. But if your doctor puts you on that high 4 gram prescription EPA dose for high triglycerides, you absolutely must be monitored for symptoms like palpitations or shortness of breath.
So for general use, what's a good target dose? And how should you take it?
For general optimization, if you're not in that specific high-risk category, aiming for about 1 gram a day of combined EPA and DHA is a solid target. And here is the crucial absorption tip. Omega-3s are fat-soluble. They must be taken with food, preferably a meal that contains some fat, to be absorbed properly.
Taking them on an empty stomach is basically a waste of money.
Largely, yes. They won't be incorporated effectively.
All right, let's move on to coenzyme Q10, or COQ10. This supplement is almost synonymous with taking a statin, but its benefits seem to go much further. Why is that link to statins so strong?
COQ10, which is also called ubiquinone, is absolutely vital for making energy in our cells. It works in the mitochondria, the cell's powerhouses, and the non-obvious connection to statins is purely biochemical.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Statins block that HMG-CoA reductase enzyme. That enzyme controls something called the mevalonate pathway, which is the factory route for making cholesterol.
Why the cholesterol pathway?
But here's the kicker. The body uses that exact same pathway to make its own COQ1N. So when you block the pathway to lower cholesterol, you are inadvertently also slowing down COQ1N production.
So taking a statin depletes COQ1N just as a side effect of how it works.
Precisely. And this depletion, especially in muscle tissue, is the leading theory for why some people get SAMS statin-associated muscle symptoms, like muscle pain, cramps, or fatigue.
So does the evidence show that taking COQ1 actually helps with that muscle pain?
The evidence here is a bit mixed, to be honest. Some big meta-analyses show a modest benefit. Others show no difference from placebo. But given that COQ1 is extremely safe, most doctors would agree that if a patient on a statin develops muscle pain, a trial of COQ1, maybe 100 to 200 milligrams a day, is a really worthwhile, low-risk thing to try.
But the truly dramatic effects of COQ1N weren't in muscle pain. They were in heart failure. This is where the numbers are just staggering.
This is one of the most compelling stories in all of supplement science. It's the Q-NSMBO trial from 2014. They tested COQ1 300 milligrams a day in patients with moderate to severe heart failure. The idea was to just give more fuel to a failing heart muscle.
And the outcomes?
They were astonishing. Over 2 years, the patients getting COQ1 had a 43% relative reduction in major adverse cardiovascular events. And even more powerfully, a 49% reduction in all-cause mortality.
A 49% reduction in dying. Those numbers are bigger than some prescription drugs.
They are. It really elevates COQ1N from, you know, a supplement for muscle aches to a potentially life-saving agent in that very specific, very sick population.
So for our healthy optimizer, what's a good dose?
For general optimization, especially if you're on a statin or, as we'll discuss, red yeast rice, a dose of 100 to 300 milligrams a day is standard. And just like omega-3s, it's fat soluble. You must take it with a meal containing fat.
And we should highlight the one big interaction here.
Yes. COQ19 is structurally similar to vitamin K, so it can interfere with the blood thinner warfarin. If you're on warfarin, you need to talk to your doctor before starting or stopping COQ19 so they can monitor your INR, your blood thinness level.
Okay, let's talk about two supplements that offer consistent, evidence-based, if maybe more modest, wins. Magnesium and aged garlic extract. Let's start with magnesium.
Magnesium is a critical mineral. It's involved in over 300 different biochemical reactions, many of which are key for regulating blood vessel tone and heart rhythm. And the simple fact is, many people in the U.S. just don't get enough from their diet.
We have good data on its effect on blood pressure, right?
We do. Multiple meta-analyses show that oral magnesium can lower blood pressure by an average of about 2.8 millimeters of mercury systolic and 2.0 diastolic in the general population.
And it's even more effective if your blood pressure is already high.
Yes. In people who are already hypertensive, the effect is larger. We see drops of around 7.7 millimeters of mercury systolic. A drop of nearly 8 points from a mineral is highly respectable.
You also mentioned it can improve heart rate variability, which we've talked about being crucial for autonomic balance.
Absolutely. There are randomized trials showing 400 milligrams of magnesium daily can significantly improve the parasympathetic side of HRV, specifically by increasing the RMSSD score. This suggests better stress resilience and a better balanced nervous system.
So for someone wanting to try it, what form and timing is best?
The main thing is to avoid the cheapest form, magnesium oxide. It's poorly absorbed and mostly just acts as a laxative. You want to look for highly bioavailable forms like magnesium glycinate or magnesium malate.
And the dose?
200 to 400 milligrams a day is typical. A lot of people like taking it in the evening. It has some relaxing properties that can help with sleep, which then further boosts your HRV.
Okay, next up, the surprising power of garlic, specifically aged garlic extract, or AGE.
AGE is severely underrated. It contains these unique, stable sulfur compounds that have really complex anti-inflammatory and vasodilatory effects, which means they help relax and widen your blood vessels.
How does it stack up against magnesium for blood pressure?
It's even more powerful. Meta-analyses found AGE dropped systolic blood pressure by about 8.3 millimeters of mercury in diastolic by 5.5 in hypertensive patients.
That reduction is comparable to a prescription medication. That's an unexpected success.
It is. But here's maybe the most compelling benefit. Studies by Dr. Matthew Bodoff have shown that AGE doesn't just slow the growth of arterial plaque, it specifically reduced the progression of coronary calcification by about 40% compared to placebo. It also seems to stabilize the more vulnerable soft plaques.
So you get a dual benefit? Great blood pressure reduction, and proven anti-plaque activity.
Exactly. The dose is usually 600 to 1200 milligrams of aged garlic extract daily. And because it's the aged extract, you don't get the same unpleasant odor or GI side effects of raw garlic.
Okay, we've established statins are the most potent tool for lowering LDL-C. But there's a category of supplements so effective, they're basically indistinguishable from drugs. Let's enter the natural drug zone, starting with red yeast rice, or RYR.
RYR is the ultimate edge case that reveals the principle. It's fermented rice, and it naturally contains a compound called monacholin K. And here's the fact that changes everything. Monacholin K is chemically identical to the prescription statin drug lovastatin.
So we need to be crystal clear. Red yeast rice is not an alternative to a statin. It is a statin.
It is a naturally derived, unregulated statin, and because it's chemically a drug, it works.
Yep.
RYR lowers LDL by a pretty significant 15 to 25%, which is right in line with a low-dose pharmaceutical statin.
And we even have outcome data for it.
We do. The CACSPS trial in China back in 2008 showed that RYR extract led to a 30% reduction in subsequent heart attacks in patients who'd already had one. It's proven to work on outcomes.
But if it acts exactly like lovastatin, it has to carry all the same risks and interactions.
So that is the critical safety caveat. You have to treat it like a drug. First, potency varies wildly between brands. Second, and this is dangerous, some products are contaminated with a toxin called citrulline, which can damage the kidney.
So you need third-party testing.
Absolutely essential.
Yeah.
And third, it has the same side effect profile as lovastatin potential for muscle pain. You should monitor liver enzymes. And the same drug interactions.
Meaning you have to avoid grapefruit juice.
You have to avoid grapefruit juice, and you should absolutely never combine it with a prescription statin. That would be an uncontrolled overdose, raising the risk of severe muscle damage. It's a potent tool, but it demands respect.
Okay, let's look at two other compounds that can help lower LDL, but through different additive pathways. First, plant sterols and stanols.
These are basically cholesterol's molecular cousins. They're found in plants, and their structure is very similar to cholesterol. Their mechanism is really simple and local. They just get in the way. They compete with dietary cholesterol for absorption in your gut.
And what's the proven effect size of getting in the way?
Taking 2 to 3 grams a day is proven to lower LDL-C by a very consistent 7 to 12%. It's modest, but the key is that it's entirely additive to the effect of a statin. It can be that little extra push you need to get to your goal.
And to make that work, you have to take them with your meals, right?
You have to. They need to be in the gut at the same time as the fat and cholesterol from your food. So the ideal way is to split the dose across your two biggest meals of the day.
Finally, let's touch on the promising citrus extract, bergamot.
Bergamot is really interesting. It contains these unique polyphenols that seem to have a sophisticated triple action mechanism. It might weakly inhibit HMG-CoA reductase, like a statin. It also seems to upregulate LDL receptors, also like a statin.
Okay.
But here's the really interesting part. Some preliminary data suggests it might also inhibit an enzyme called PCSK9.
Wait, PCSK9 inhibitors are some of the newest, most powerful, and most expensive injectable cholesterol drugs on the market.
Potentially, yes. Now, the data is still early and from smaller trials, but the efficacy they've seen is noteworthy. Doses around 1,500 milligrams a day have shown LDL reductions up to 34%.
34% is a huge reduction for a supplement. What's the major caveat here?
The caveat is just the maturity of the evidence. We don't have the huge long-term outcome trials like we have for statins, but it's generally considered safe. And unlike grapefruit, it doesn't have major CYP3A4 inhibitor activity. It's a very promising tool, especially for people who can't tolerate statins.
All right, we have meticulously filtered the winners. Now, let's aggressively filter the failures. These are the supplements that looked great on paper, had sound hypotheses, but just failed catastrophically in large clinical trials, and in some cases, even proved to be harmful.
High-dose niacin, which is vitamin B's, is the absolute poster child for a failure based on a flawed biomarker hypothesis. Niacin is a very potent lipid modifier. It powerfully raises HDL-C, the good cholesterol, and it lowers triglycerides.
And the thinking was pretty simple. If high HDL is good, then making HDL higher must be good.
That was the hypothesis.
Yeah.
And it led to two massive definitive trials, AIMHIGH and HPS2THRIVE. They added high-dose niacin up to 2 grams a day to thousands of patients who were already on statins.
And what was the outcome?
It was a spectacular failure that completely reset the field. Niacin caused zero added cardiovascular benefit, no reduction in heart attacks or strokes, even though it successfully raised HDL. But here's the real problem. It significantly increased serious adverse events.
What kind of adverse events?
Most notably, it increased the rate of newly diagnosed diabetes by 32%. It also caused significant increases in serious infections, bleeding, and liver problems. The risks were clear, and the benefit was zero.
So the lesson is brutal but simple. You can't just manipulate a biomarker like HDL and expect that to translate into better health.
That's it. The conclusion is firm. Niacin is not recommended for routine CV prevention in the statin era. The risks clearly outweigh any supposed benefits.
This next one is another huge disappointment. The hypothesis that high-dose antioxidant vitamins like E, C, and beta-carotene would prevent heart disease was just everywhere.
It was a beautiful theory that completely failed the clinical test. Large randomized trials just universally failed to show a benefit. And worse, in some cases, they actually caused harm.
Tell us about the harm from vitamin E.
The HOPETOO trial was one of the biggest. It studied high-dose vitamin E, 400 IOs a day. Not only did it fail to prevent heart attacks, but later meta-analyses found that high-dose vitamin E was actually associated with an increased risk of heart failure and even all-cause mortality.
So it actually made things worse.
It did. And beta-carotene was found to increase the risk of lung cancer in smokers with no CV benefit.
This completely flips the script for so many people who see antioxidant on a label and just assume it's good for them.
The body handles antioxidants from whole foods very differently than it handles these isolated high-dose pills. The conclusion is unambiguous. Get your antioxidants from fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Avoid the high-dose pills for CV prevention.
Okay, two more huge supplement categories where the heart health evidence just isn't there. Let's start with vitamin D.
Right. Observational studies showed this strong correlation. People with low vitamin D had higher rates of CVD. This fueled massive interest. But correlation isn't causation.
And we got the definitive answer from the VITAL trial.
We did. The VITAL trial was enormous. 21,000 people followed for years. And for vitamin D supplementation, 2,000 IUE a day, the result was an extreme comparison.
What did they find?
Zero significant reduction in major cardiovascular events, heart attack, stroke, nothing. Absolutely none.
So to simplify, you need vitamin D for your bones, for your immune system, but don't megadose it thinking it's going to protect your heart.
That's the perfect summary. Ensure you're sufficient. Get your levels between 30 and 50 nanograms per milliliter, but don't view it as a CV prevention tool.
And finally, let's talk about the B vitamins folate, B uro, and the homocysteine hypothesis failure.
High levels of an amino acid called homocysteine correlate with CVD risk. And we know that B vitamins are very effective at lowering homocysteine. So the hypothesis was simple. Lower the risk factor, lower the events.
But again, the big trials didn't prove it.
They did not. Trials like HOPE2 and NORVIT showed that while the B vitamins successfully dropped homocysteine levels, this did not translate to fewer heart attacks or deaths in well-nourished populations like in the U.S. and Europe.
So unless you have a documented B vitamin deficiency, there's no supported reason to supplement for heart health.
Correct. The focus should be on correcting a documented deficiency, not general CV prevention.
Okay, we have covered so much evidence, from statin timing to the paradox of EPA. Now we need to synthesize this into a practical daily protocol. What should our listener take and when to really maximize absorption and synergy?
We have to start with the solubility rules so we're not just wasting money on things that aren't being absorbed.
Okay.
First, the fat-soluble compounds. That's vitamins A, D, E, K, omega-3s, and COQ10. These must be taken with a meal that contains fat. It's non-negotiable for good absorption.
And the water-soluble ones?
Those are things like B vitamins and magnesium. They can be taken without food, but they're often better taken with food just to prevent any minor stomach upset.
Okay, so based on those rules and everything we've talked about, let's build an example of a rational, evidence-based daily stack.
Okay, a highly optimized protocol could look something like this. Morning, with a fat-containing breakfast, this is the perfect time for your fat solubles. So you take your omega-3, 1 to 2 grams, and your vitamin D if you're taking it.
Then what about with lunch and dinner?
If you're using plant sterols or stanols, they need to be there to block absorption. So you split the dose, 2 to 3 grams total, across your two biggest meals.
And then the evening. This seems to be a key time for a lot of these.
It is. This is the window for nocturnal effects. If you're on a short-acting statin or red yeast rice, you take it with dinner or at bedtime to hit that peak cholesterol synthesis window. This is also the best time for magnesium, maybe 200 to 400 milligrams of glycinate or malate, because it promotes relaxation and can improve your HRV while you sleep.
And if you're on aspirin?
If you're indicated for low-dose aspirin, take it right before bed. That ensures you have maximum antiplatelet effect during those high-risk morning hours.
I love that. It's so structured. It's not just, should I take this, but how do I take this optimally? Let's talk about synergies, using two supplements together for a combined effect.
The classic synergy is red yeast rice plus COQ10. Since RYR acts like a statin and depletes COQ10, taking them together is a smart prophylactic move to hopefully mitigate any potential for muscle aches.
You're using one to counteract the side effect of the other? What about for blood pressure?
You can combine the big hitters for blood pressure, aged garlic extract, omega-3s, and magnesium. They all work through completely different pathways. So when you combine them, their modest effects become additive. It's a comprehensive multi-pathway approach.
This all leads to the non-negotiable step of quality assurance. Supplements operate in a significant regulatory gap.
That gap is the crucial difference. The FDA doesn't oversee them like prescription drugs. This means the dose on the label can be wrong, and the risk of contamination with heavy metals or toxins is very real.
We saw that with red yeast rice and the kidney toxin citrulline. What about with something as common as fish oil?
Fish oil can be rancid, meaning it's oxidized, which can actually introduce oxidative stress. Or it can be contaminated with heavy metals like mercury. A cheap, poorly sourced product can do more harm than good.
So how does the listener verify quality?
You have to look for voluntary third-party testing seals on the label. It is the only way to know what you're actually getting. The three most reliable seals in the U.S. are the USP Verified Mark, the NSF International Contents Certified Mark, and the ConsumerLab.com Seal of Approval.
So paying a little more for a verified product is a necessity, not a luxury.
It's an absolute necessity when you're using these potent compounds.
Okay, let's zoom out. After four deep dives on optimization, how do all these pills compare to the foundational lifestyle changes we started with?
Supplements offer incremental gains. They are adjuncts. They are tools for fine-tuning an already excellent foundation. The risk reduction you get from losing 15 pounds, from doing high VO2 max intervals, that provides a greater multi-system benefit than any single pill we've discussed.
Lifestyle is still the 800-pound gorilla.
Absolutely. But they work together. If your lipids or blood pressure are still a little high despite a perfect lifestyle, then these evidence-based supplements are an intelligent next step.
And if those steps still aren't enough to hit your targets.
That brings us to the escalation principle. If your risk dictates it, if your LDL is still stubbornly high despite your best efforts, you should not delay proper medical therapy like a prescription statin. They provide the greatest, most proven risk reduction in history. The goal is integration, using the best evidence for the job, not avoiding medical science.
So to wrap this up, what's the summary?
In summary, for that 40-year-old optimizer, the evidence points to a focused smart stack. Prioritize pharmaceuticals like statins or aspirin when your risk dictates. For supplements, focus on high-dose EPA for very specific situations, COQ-9 to support statin use, aged garlic and magnesium for blood pressure, and maybe red yeast rice or plant sterols for LDL. And you must avoid the proven failures like high-dose niacin and antioxidant vitamins.
The evidence is complex. It's so dependent on dosage, formulation, and your own personal context. But by building on that lifestyle foundation and then strategically layering these evidence-based tools, you can create a really powerful defense. And remember, the most important part is monitoring. Check your numbers, track your data, make sure what you're doing is actually working for you.
And we spent a lot of time on the REBU-CEIT trial, which showed high-dose EPA can dramatically reduce heart attacks. But we also highlighted that it increases the risk of atrial fibrillation.
Right, that surprising and non-obvious connection.
It raises this fascinating question that cardiologists are grappling with right now. In the future, will we need to do routine, maybe even genetic screening for a patient's predisposition to AF before we prescribe high-dose EPA? Or will the profound confirmed reduction in dying from a heart attack be deemed universally worth that slightly higher arrhythmia risk?
That is the ethical and clinical tightrope we have to think about. A fascinating thought to mull over as the research continues to unfold.